Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller. We're going to be talking about cancer in the first half of the show. We're going to be talking with Dr. Goel. He's Director of Epigenetics and Cancer Prevention at the Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. We're going to be talking with him. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about heart health. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
New research suggests antibiotics appear to be overused in many neonatal intensive care units. The study authors found just how often these medications were used varied widely. Some neonatal intensive care units gave antibiotics to newborns at a rate 40 times greater than rates at other NICUs, even when there was little difference in infection rates. The findings were published online April 20th in the journal Pediatrics. In the study, California health officials analyzed the medical care of more than 52,000 infants in 127 neonatal intensive care units across the state in 2013. Pets can transfer infections to humans, especially young children, seniors, pregnant women, and those with weakened immune systems, experts report. Pet owners and healthcare providers need to be aware of this risk and take steps to protect vulnerable people, say the authors of a review published in the April 20th issue of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. All pets can transmit disease to people, including salmonella, drug-resistant bacteria, campylobacter, and parasitic diseases such as hookworm, roundworm, and toxoplasmosis. The infections can be transmitted through bites, scratches, saliva, and contact with feces. Reptiles and amphibians can transmit diseases indirectly, such as on contaminated surfaces. An expert at the American Migraine Foundation suggests if you don't know whether or not your headache is just a headache or if it's actually a migraine, you may be missing out on effective treatments. A Foundation news release indicates between 36 million and 40 million Americans experience migraines, and many of those people never get a formal diagnosis or proper treatment from a migraine specialist. You might have migraine if you experience two or more of the following symptoms: moderate to severe head pain, throbbing head pain, often to one side of the head, head pain that lasts from 4 hours to several days, nausea or vomiting, headaches that worsen with any physical activity or movement, sensitivity to light, sound, and odors, difficulty concentrating and processing information due to the headache, head pain associated with dizziness or vertigo, headaches severe enough to make you miss work or other activities, temporary vision or language problems, or tingling and numbness in addition to the headache. And finally, being well-educated doesn't necessarily mean you'll be happy with your life, a new British study suggests. The authors of the new study say previous research has found a strong link between low levels of education and mental illness, so they wanted to find out if levels of education were associated with mental well-being, defined as feeling good and functioning well. The University of Warwick researchers explained people with high levels of mental well-being are more likely to feel happy and contented with their lives because of the way they deal with problems and challenges, particularly relationship issues. The researchers analyzed the responses of more than 17,000 people in England. They were surveyed in 2010 and 2011. People with varying levels of education had similar odds of having high levels of mental well-being. The study was published recently in the British Journal of Psychiatry.
Well, our first guest has lots of education and hopefully is experiencing some well-being today. Dr. Goel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm quite excited.
So tell us a little bit about, you're the director of epigenetics and cancer prevention and genomics at Baylor University. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty diverse title. So what that means is I study cancer. Mm-hmm. That's my area of study. But within cancer, you can have different aspects of cancer. And my specialization is mostly in cancer epigenetics, which is a term which we have begun to sort of appreciate in the last decade or so. And now we know that most diseases, and particularly when it comes to cancer, it is not all about genetics. It's all not in your genes. It is something, the process we have learned is epigenetics, which is a compound word, epi and genetics. What that means is essentially this is a process which basically tells us how the information stored in our DNA can be utilized. So, in other words, we all are born with a certain amount of information in our DNA, which is our genetics, but by itself, that doesn't serve us any good. So So we need to do things. We need to maintain a good lifestyle so the genes behave the way they're supposed to. But if you're maintaining not so good lifestyle, then these genes begin to behave in a negative fashion, and that's what puts it at risk for getting different diseases. So this has been a broad area of my research, and it is very much applicable to virtually every disease, but particularly to cancer.
Now, tell us a little bit about cancer, because I've heard that, you know, everyone gets cancer four or five times in their lifetime, and that our body's immune system takes care of it for the most part. Is that true from what you've researched?
Absolutely. I think that is true. I think our bodies are wonderful, wonderful machines in a way. You know, they're built so evolutionarily, they're so strong that probably on a daily basis we are exposed to so many different stresses or foreign bodies that we don't even recognize them. And so our body is a very intact system, and our immune system is one of the most powerful things around. So anytime our bodies are exposed to anything which we are not supposed to be reacting, let's say for bacteria or viruses and other things, so our immune system responds as soon as they see a foreign pathogen around us, and they take care of it. And I think we all blessed to have such strong immune systems. But as we age, and this is part of the thing, and most of the chronic illnesses, they begin to show up as we all age. And as we age, our immune system becomes somewhat compromised with every day we live. So most of the illnesses, cancer especially, is a disease of elderly. So as we get older, our immune system is not as strong, and that puts it at risk that anytime we are exposed to some of these pathogens, we are at risk for getting more and more diseases, and cancer being one of them.
Does cancer deserve the fear that it invokes in much of the population in North America?
I would say no. I think cancer is a disease which we can... I mean, you would say that, or the people listening would say that everybody's been hearing there's a lot more cancer around us now than what we used to hear probably a few decades ago. And I think that it's a twofold problem. One is, with the advancing technologies around us, now we have become a lot more sophisticated. We have tools now that we can see some of these cancers which we would have missed otherwise a few years ago. You know, so we have become better at diagnosing cancer. So I think that's part of the problem, that a lot of people are being worried that, oh, I have a cancer. But at the same time, there's some truth to this as well, that the cancer incidence is increasing too, while we're getting better at diagnosing it, but the cancer incidence is growing too. And I think that has something to do with the diets and the lifestyles we are choosing to live. Yes, it is growing, but the good news is that We can control it. We can mitigate. We can reduce the risk for getting cancer by making very simple, subtle changes in our daily diets and lifestyles.
What is the relationship between stress, Dr. Joel, and cancer from your research?
Stress, I think, is a fundamental problem for, again, most diseases. And the way it works is that, unlike any foreign pathogens or bacteria or viruses, when they attack our body, our immune system recognizes them a lot more effectively, and it attacks that pathogen and takes care of it. But stress is something which is not a foreign entity. It is something which is inherent to our bodies. And our immune system, over time, begins to sort of becomes dismissive of that. So in other words, This is a problem which we continue to expose our bodies at a very small level over long periods of time, and this becomes sort of a second nature for our immune system, and it tends to fool our immune system to cope up with that stress. So as a result, once we have a continuous bouts of repeated stress, it evades or escapes of the immune system to take care of it. And as a result, it leads to so many different processes, and one being inflammation. So when we are continuously stressed, it invokes a small, low level of chronic inflammatory stress, which is primarily the reason for a lot of chronic illnesses, including cancer.
Interesting. I want to ask you, Dr. Gull, how did you first get involved in studying cancer? You've been doing it for 20 years, so you're a bit of an expert in the field, but what really kind of got you interested in that?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. So this has been a fun journey. So when I first got started in cancer, essentially it was just about when I finished my doctorate and I was looking for a new chapter in my life. I wanted to do something which can make a difference in, you know, people's lives, and I began to look at what should be my next research topic. And you go through a lot of literature as a scientist to see what are the problems out there. And when I began to look at literature, at that time I was in India. I graduated. I did my doctorate there, and I was looking what should be the next topic of my research. And it was baffling. It was very pronounced to me when I look at the cancer incidence across the globe. There was a very clear disparity in different populations. That was quite puzzling to me. Why would cancer be very different, cancer rates, cancer incidence, cancer-related deaths and mortality be very different in different parts of the world? Because as humans, we are very similar. We may look a little bit different, we may behave a little bit different, but on a genetic level, as humans, we are, you know, 99.99999% very similar. So I said, why so? So when I look at that, then when I specifically look at the cancer incidence, being in India, it was, again, very surprising to me that India is one of the nations which has lowest incidence of virtually every cancer. Hmm. Lowest incidence of virtually every cancer in the planet. And U.S., on the other end, has one of the highest incidence of every cancer. So that was quite intriguing to me because anybody outside of U.S., you know, everybody looks up to U.S. We have one of the best healthcare systems here. We have some of the smartest minds here. We have the best technologies here. And it was quite confusing to me. It did not connect well with me. It didn't resonate well with me. How could U.S. be one of those nations with the highest incidences of cancer? And India, where poverty is a problem, you know, people are not educated. They can't afford a good meal. But still, they're doing something which is protecting them from having cancer. And not just cancer, but several other diseases, including Alzheimer's and other things. So then I began to systematically look, and I saw that it is not the genes, it is not the genetics, it is the diets. And if you look at a typical Indian meal versus a Western meal, you can tell the difference. Indian meals are full of a lot of spices and herbs, and a lot of these have been shown for centuries to have some medicinal benefits versus Western food, which is quite bland. So, not to simplify too much, but definitely I realized long ago that it is something to do with diets and lifestyles. And that was the reason I got into that, to systematically tease it apart and study why different people living in different parts of the world would have different risk for having cancer. Mm.
Did it have anything to do with the culture as well? Was there any correlation between culture, how people spent their time, and cancer?
Well, at that time, no. I did not have, that was not the reasons I got into it, because there was tons and tons of science out there that clearly supported the paradigm, the hypothesis that it is the diets and lifestyles. Yes, you can argue that the lifestyle may somehow fit with what you're asking, but I think it's predominantly the stuff we eat or get exposed to on a daily basis. So people have done these beautiful migratory studies that when populations move from one part of the world, it's the same bodies, they move to another part of the world, their risk for getting the disease where they moved gets almost similar within one generation once they've lived there. Mm. So it's not the genes, it's the same body. For example, Japanese historically had, in 1940s and 50s, had one of the lowest incidence of colon cancer, which is my area of expertise. They had one of the lowest incidence of colon cancer in 1940s and 50s in Japanese population. But once they moved for work to Hawaii, within one generation, within 20 years, their risk for getting colon cancer was similar to native Hawaiians. So what is the first thing you do when you move somewhere? You adopt local diets. You change your diets. You change your lifestyle. And that was, again, the compelling reason for me to begin to continue to tease this apart, to understand why and how, what is the role of diets and lifestyles in different diseases, including cancer.
We're talking with Dr. A.J. Goel. He's the Director of Epigenetics at Baylor University Medical Center. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be finding out more about how you can prevent cancer.